from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we explore the life and legacy of politician and civil rights activist Bell Phillips. Then we learn about an upcoming Milwaukee holiday market highlighting Black-owned businesses.
There's some amazing Black talent, amazing Black businesses, amazing Black art in this city, and it deserves to be put a spotlight on.
Plus, our latest Live at Lake Effect features Blitz and Trapper, who shares one of the stories behind the origin of their band name.
Well, it's not entirely a lie, although it may be. In sixth grade, I had a Christmas-themed Trapper Keeper that I would keep all my pens in and my writings and my crappy poems. And all my love letters from my sixth-grade girlfriend were in there.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Milwaukee politician Bell Phillips died in 2018 at the age of 94. 6 years after her death, recognition of her monumental impact on Milwaukee and Wisconsin continues to grow. In 2024, it can be hard to appreciate the dedication and tenacity it took for Phillips to succeed after she started her political career in 1956 at the age of 32. But here's a reminder of all the firsts she accomplished. Vel Phillips was the first Black person and first woman to serve on the Milwaukee Common Council, the first Black elected statewide office holder in Wisconsin, and the first Black person elected to the Democratic Party's National Committee. From pioneering open housing legislation to serving as Wisconsin's Secretary of State, Phillips influenced countless crucial moments of our history. Recently, she's been recognized with a state statue at the Capitol and a plaza in Milwaukee. Writer Barbara Miner dove into Phillips' history and impact for an article in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. She joins me now to share more about it. Barbara Miner, welcome back to Lake Effect. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you. It's always nice to be at WUWM.
Glad to have you. So we're talking about a very important woman today, Vel Phillips. And obviously a lot of people, especially locally, are familiar with Vel's accomplishments and her political career. But can you share more about her early years and her background?
Very complicated. And Vel is a complicated person. I mean, her very early background, she was born in Milwaukee, raised here in Milwaukee, but her parents were part of what was then sort of the established African-American community. Her father was a small businessman, restaurant, garage owner. So Vel grew up in relative, and I say that very loosely, relative comfort. And in fact, she talks about in her very early years when she went door-to-door with the League of Women Voters, and was just horrified at some of the conditions. And she said it broke her heart. And of those early years, her mother was clearly her strongest influence. And one of the things that is so associated with Vel is something her mother always said, which was, dream big. And Vel took that and other lessons from her mother, but took that to heart.
Vel has a ton of accomplishments. You know, we can't list and talk about all of them in our conversation today, but her political career started, you know, officially, shall we say, when she was 32 years old, she became the first woman and the first Black person on the Milwaukee Common Council. So can you share more context about the atmosphere and culture she was working in 1956?
Yes, the 1950s on some levels could as well be the 18th century in terms of how different it is from today. And I grew up in the 50s, you know, younger, but it's hard, I think, sometimes to appreciate what that culture was like for women and for Black people, but particularly women. I mean, for instance, there was not the approval of oral contraceptives until the 1960s, I think. Betty Friedan's The Feminist Mystique was not until the 1960s. And interestingly, it wasn't until 1974, we're talking 22 years after Vel was first elected, that women could have their own bank account or credit card. And so the 50s were a complicated decade, coming off of World War II, economic prosperity in many ways. But the life for a lot of women and people of color was very different. And after the war, women were expected to go home and make babies.
And, you know, you touched upon some of the atmosphere for women. and then for Black people. And Vel obviously has a lot of compounded discrimination that she had experienced long before, you know, intersectionality had been a common word, right? Can you share a little more about that? Because you had a conversation with her about what stood out to her the most about that.
Well, interestingly, I did a feature on Vel in 2005. Hard to believe that's, what, almost 20 years ago. And I had the good fortune to really, I drove her around, we had interviews, we spent some time together. And I would go to events where she would be, like community brainstorming, where she would be moderating. And we'd have lunch and, you know, conversations. And at one point, I asked her, because she was known as the first woman, the first African American, I said, well, what was the hardest breakthrough? And initially, she just kind of, you know, thought about it and just said, you know, it was difficult, so to speak. And then a week or two later at the community brainstorming, she comes back to me. She says, you know, I've been thinking about that, and I really want to clarify. And then she talked about Shirley Chisholm, who is a African-American woman legislator from New York who also ran for president in the 60s. And she was friends with Vel. I mean, there weren't that many women African-American politicians, and so they all knew each other. And Vel said, you know, Shirley and I talked about this, and you're Black. Of course you're Black. And people know you're Black, and they don't forget that. But you're also a woman. But usually, once I was in a position, they kind of forgot that I was a Black woman. She said, but they never, ever, ever forgot I was a woman.
So powerful, right? Like, and sad that that's the takeaway.
Yes. Although, interestingly, I mean, misogyny was ever present from the moment she stepped foot into the Common Council chambers. A lot of stories there. But it was really the issue of her being an African-American politician. That was the issue that really led to sort of concerns about her personal safety and the safety of her children. So while one was ever-present and aggravating, it did not rise to the level of physically threatening her, and that wasn't true around the open housing marches.
Right. Let's talk about the marches. Obviously, it's one of her key legacies is the open housing legislation. And I feel like most people know the marches and have a certain snapshot in their head, especially if they weren't alive during that time. Like, we see the same kind of handful of photographs, right? But Vel was trying to act on this long before the marching tactic became enacted, right?
Oh, she was the first person to introduce the open housing legislation. And it was in 1962. We're talking, you know, 5 years before the open housing marches. In 1962, she first introduced open housing legislation, which would prohibit discrimination against African Americans in terms of renting and buying homes, which was very common at the time, open discrimination. And I believe it was like 15 to 1, she was the only person who voted in favor of it. And there were times, there were years, where it wasn't even discussed. She would bring up the resolution, no discussion, there'd be a vote, she would be the only person in support of the legislation.
And then eventually down the road in 67, she throws herself behind the tactic championed by Father James Grappi here and the local NAACP Youth Council, which was the public demonstrations. And I feel like this is lost in some of the snapshots, how extensive it was, how dramatic.
Well, in the mid-60s is when just everything exploded. And 1967 nationally was sort of this national unrest. There were, you know, uprisings in Newark, Detroit. They called the troops into Detroit, Lyndon B. Johnson. And Father Grappi, shortly before that, had started the demonstrations for open housing. Grappi and the Youth Council were sort of an in the streets. Vel was here working with the politicians on the legislation. And Grappi, they came to Vel and said, listen, we want to take this up as an issue. They'd been doing other issues around school desegregation, the Eagles Club and their discriminatory practices. And they said, Vel, we want to take this up. And Vel said, go right ahead. She wasn't always out there in the demonstrations because she was acutely aware of the different roles at times. But it was in 67 when things just went kind of crazy. I mean, I don't quite know how to describe it, but that was when, in line with all the different uprisings in Newark, Detroit, Milwaukee had its own. And what started it and how and why, there might be some differences of opinion. But what is known is that Mayor Meyer immediately in sort of classic Milwaukee German fashion, shut down the entire city. Mail service was suspended. People were not allowed to leave their homes. It was just a complete and total shutdown. And the demonstrations had started before that. Things shut down. Some other things happened. But the bottom line is that after that shutdown was lifted, the demonstrations began again. And this is when Grappi and the commandos decided to go across the viaduct into the south side. And that night that they decided to do that, they were met on the south side. It was just as ugly as anything Milwaukee has ever seen. Bricks, racial epithets, things being thrown at the demonstrators, you know, go back to Africa, you know, calling, you know, Grappi a traitor, you know, to his race. Just ugly, ugly, ugly. But the demonstrators were determined. So for 200 consecutive nights, because I think back to George Floyd in 2020, but I'm thinking here, and that was the summer.
Right.
Here we have 200 nights in the middle of a Milwaukee winter, and they kept marching. And then again, yeah. Once the national events intervened, mm-hmm. because that spring in April, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And again, just uprisings and protests all around the city. And at that point, and I think to this day, it remains the largest civil rights demonstration in Milwaukee history. Well, needless to say, about 2 weeks afterwards, the federal open housing legislation passed, and finally, Milwaukee woke up to reality. Some new alder people had been elected, and finally, the open housing legislation passed.
As we know, Vel, we obviously identify her with Milwaukee, with Wisconsin. But her impact on the national stage is also really good, too. And you go into her roles in the DNC both in 1958 and the 1960 conventions. Can you explain kind of how Vel set herself apart on the national scale here?
Well, it's fascinating. And again, a lot of it had to do with open housing. That's always been both locally and nationally her political marker, her main issue. But in 58, she was elected to the Democratic National Committee, first African-American woman. And then 2 years later, at the convention when Kennedy was nominated. So not surprisingly, there was lots of discussion and floor fights over the platform. And there was a push for a strong civil rights platform as part of the Democratic Party platform. And you had your Southern Dems, the sort of segregationists, who said, oh, no, we can't adopt this civil rights platform. You're going to lose the South. This is government-enforced social equality. And they were adamantly opposed. And Val was on the committee. And one of the lessons here is don't ever get into a political fight with Val. She was so, so smart. And she always had a good response. So she says to the senator, well, how can you expect the world to, you know, respect us if we don't even enforce equality here at home? But then more importantly, she said something that I think actually remains one of Val's enduring markers of her beliefs. And she said, listen, it's more important to do the right thing. Luckily, the civil rights platform carried the day, and Kennedy won the election because the Southern segregationists, they said, oh, no, you're going to lose the election if you adopt this. But they didn't.
You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski speaking with Barbara Miner about her Milwaukee Magazine article on Vel Phillips. So, Barbara, you mentioned that Vel always thought it's more important to do the right thing. And I think it's kind of a through line for Vel in that throughout her whole career and all the challenges she faced, like there's the resilience, there's the tenacity, there's the quiet leadership by example. And she was many things, obviously, including proud, but she kept her personal life quite private, right?
Yes. Understandably, as a politician and as a woman. But one of the things that I think it's really important to get into about Val, in terms of her do the right thing, you know, to her dying day, she supported marriage equality. She supported a woman's right to choose. She supported LGBTQ. She supported, you know, school desegregation. She strongly supported public schools and opposed the voucher program. You know, you name an issue. She was a Bernie Sanders big supporter. You name an issue, and she came down on what, in hindsight, almost everyone recognizes was the right thing.
And she constantly fought for the right thing and for others, even if in her own personal life there was tragedy, right?
Yeah, Val was quiet about her personal life. I mean, first of all, she had this storybook romance and marriage to Dale. In fact, if you talk to Val's son, Michael, he calls his dad sometimes an original Mr. Mom.
Oh, sure.
Because while Val is out there, you know, going to the Common Council, demonstrating, doing this, doing that, Dale actually took care of a lot of the home front while he helped develop a respected law firm, largest black law firm in the state. He was part of the NAACP. He helped one of the big banks, the black banks in town. He, in his own right, was a very, very well-respected person. But Val was the one who was the politician, and he knew that, and he supported her in it. So Val didn't talk about it much, but people who knew when Dale died, somewhat unexpectedly of a heart attack, she lost it. And she, you know, Gwen Moore, who has known Val since high school, will talk about this, and she'll say, you know, Val was thinking of running for Congress, and then Dale died, and she just fell apart. Similarly, in another sort of tragic episode in Val's life that isn't talked about much, the PBS documentary, which I encourage people to watch, is quite well done, and it gets into it some. She had two sons, Michael and Dale Jr. And Dale Jr., when he was about 17, I think, was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. And it was hard, very hard, on everyone in the family. And Michael talks about, you know, Dale and Val, they'd have their family dinners, and at the family dinner table, that's where you solved everything. But as Michael says, you know, mental illness is not something you solve. And so Dale Jr. had his good years and his bad years. And in 2005, he died by suicide. And again, it tore Val apart. And Gwen says that Val called her after Dale Jr. committed suicide. And Gwen said she was talking in a whisper. She could barely have the energy to even say anything. But time, Val's spirit, her resilience, she was able to come back. Took a while, but she came back.
We, of course, have been talking about her local impact here in Milwaukee and Wisconsin, but let's talk about kind of how we're finally giving her her flowers 6 years after her death, and more publicly, right? There's a statue at the state capitol and the Vel R. Phillips Plaza here in Milwaukee. So how are these public and accessible spaces designed to reflect her?
It is important, I think, that she's finally getting her due. And there's a lot of reasons behind that. And one of the things I discovered in this article and over time was how well she was known at the statewide level. I mean, I know her here in Milwaukee, but a dorm was named after her in Madison. The James Madison High School is now the Val Phillips Memorial High School. She's well known around the state and in Madison. Why is she getting her due? Lots of different reasons. One, the 100th year. You know, after a century, I think people take notice. But also there's an interesting story of what happened in Madison, because it was the George Floyd protests. I mean, you know, COVID, George Floyd, that was a difficult time on many, many levels. And during one of the protests in Madison, and this had been true across the country of different statues and monuments being torn down. In the South, this was primarily Confederate segregationists. Well, in Madison, they tore down two statues. One was Lady Forward, who represents the state, you know, motto, and the other was a Norwegian-American who was an abolitionist. But interestingly, Michael Johnson, who's head of the Dane County Boys and Girls Club, he decided to go talk to the protesters. And that was a very smart move. Rather than just assuming they did what they did, why they did, he said, I'm going to talk to them. And he found that, you know, beneath the rage, beneath the anger, beneath the confusion, they had a really, really valid point that there were absolutely no statues of people of color at the Capitol. And so Michael said, you know, this is right. We should do something about it. So that began the campaign around the statue of Val Phillips at the state Capitol. And here in Milwaukee, you know, Mileli Coggs, the alderperson, has a lot to do with really making sure that Val got her due. There was the renaming of 4th Street to the Val R. Phillips Drive. And then there was this pretty dingy corner there at 4th and Wisconsin, and it was city-owned. It was like, oh, what are we going to do with this? And ultimately, someone had the good sense to say, well, yeah, let's do a plaza, and let's name it after Val.
You know, we're talking about Val Phillips and you yourself having spent time written about her in 05 and now again today in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine. What sticks out the most to you about Val? Are there any insights you want to share or details or stories that didn't make it into the article?
Well, this is a personal story because it involves my mother. And Val was very close to her mother. And I had my differences with my mother, but by the end, we were quite close. And it also underscored to me that Val was a people person. So I remember once I wanted to interview her, but we couldn't find a quiet restaurant. Everything was, downtown. And I said, you know, Val, my mom lives at the Astor Hotel, and they have a quiet little coffee shop. And she goes, oh, your mom lives at the Astor? I've always wanted to see one of those apartments. Can I go see your apartment? I said, well, so I called my mom, and my mom's going like, Val Phillips, my friend. She said, well, yeah, come on up. My mom was nervous because Val's pretty famous, and
yeah,
so they come
let
up.
Let me clean first, right?
Yeah. Well, my mom kept a pretty clean house, so she. So I knew my mom was a little nervous, and I'm going, well, it's an ask, Mom. But so we go up there, and there's a little bit of hi, I'm, you know, Barbara's mother, hi, Val Phillips. Within about 2 minutes, these two older women are talking about their favorite solitaire card game. I just couldn't believe it. I mean, I don't know, you know, if Val suddenly saw the card table with the cards, but all of a sudden they were like best buddies.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. Well, Barbara, thank you so much for joining me today to share more about your piece on Val Phillips. And we could talk about her for much longer, but thanks for what we talked about today.
Oh, no, thank you. And it's a homage to Val. Thank you for letting more about her get out.
Barbara Miner is a writer and photographer here in Milwaukee, and you can find her latest article about Val Phillips called Living Legacy in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Coming up in about 12 minutes, our latest Live at Lake Effect episode features Portland-based band Blitz and Trapper. The group's been together for more than 20 years and just released their 10th album. But before we hear their music, we'll learn how an upcoming holiday market is supporting Milwaukee's Black-owned businesses. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This Small Business Saturday, November 30th, there's a way to support Milwaukee's Black-owned businesses. It's called the Blackity Black Holiday Market, featuring more than 40 local entrepreneurs. WUWM's Mayan Silver spoke with the market's organizer, Tariq Moody. Moody is creative director of Hyphen, Milwaukee's digital-first Black music and culture platform. They were also joined by business owner Givenchy Hudnall-Vogel of Ghetto Mantras, a Black woman-run wellness brand.
Thank you so much both for being here, and we're here to talk about the Blackity Black Holiday Market. Tariq, I want to know, first of all, just starting with from scratch, the name Blackity Black, how did that come to you?
It just came to me. I mean, this is the third year we've been doing this. I mean, the whole goal was to create, you know, I realized that no one was doing anything really on Small Business Saturday, but I wanted to, you know, I see a lot of big markets, and I figured, like, why don't we do a big market for Small Business Saturday? So when we started with like little under 40. Last year, we got over 50 to 60, and we're still plus 40 this year. And the name is like, just want to be a little swagger, bold. And it's kind of like, let's call it Blackity Black Holiday Market. So I just remember seeing that on a post somewhere. Like, it was Black History Month. Someone posted like, February, I'm black all year long, but in February, I'm Blackity Black. So just like,
we're going to do it. It's just going to be Blackity Black. And can you tell me a little bit about these 40 local businesses? There's going to be handmade crafts, art, fashion, skincare, specialty foods. Can you give me like a snapshot? You walk in to Turner Hall. What is it going to be like?
So like, I'll give you an example of what happened last year. We're going to try to do the same thing last year. So you come in, we had a food court kind of thing, you know. So you're shopping, you get hungry, you go to a mall, there's a food court line, and we have a food court too, but it featured all Black-owned food businesses. We also have a Black Santa, Black elves, and just like, you know, in Black culture, we got to have music, right? So we got DJs from Hyphen, DJ Anthony and DJ Megan, who's two of our DJs on air, going to be DJing. We also have some performances that our partner Culture by Design is going to be working on. And we also going to have resources. So not on businesses, there'll be resource tables just like last year. So people, you know, you'll be shopping, oh, what's this organization do? So we're going to also have that as well.
That's awesome. And of course, it's happening, like you said, on Small Business Saturday. Can you tell me, what does this mean for small business entrepreneurs, for Black-owned businesses, things like that?
Well, you know, opening a business is tough, no matter what color you are. But it's tougher for Black-owned businesses in the country, especially even in Milwaukee. Well, less than 2% of the total business in Milwaukee is Black-owned, which is less than the national average. Puts Milwaukee as one of the lowest city for Black-owned businesses. And also, according to McKinsey report, there's a report out there about only about 4% of Black businesses stay open past 3.5 years compared to all businesses, 55%. So there's a lot of challenges being a small owner, business owner, but it's even more challenges, systemic challenges being a Black-owned business, including capital, access to loan, a lot of issues. And one of the biggest things that get a business out there is marketing, right? You know, that's the thing that most people will, like, not spend on, right? But that's the thing that also helps you get more customers, too. So it's a catch-22. And so we're a media outlet. Why don't we use our strength to not only have an opportunity for people to shop, but also bring awareness. There's a lot of businesses I didn't even know existed who signed up, right? So that's another thing. So it's very important, especially in Milwaukee, to just bring a light to this. And what better way to do it on Small Business Friday and bring as many businesses as we can together.
And one of the businesses that's going to be there is Ghetto Mantra. Yeah. Ghetto Mantras. Javanche, so I'm going to read a little bit of your bio on your website.
Wow.
Yeah. You're described as a bit of a math wizard.
I am.
With a long history in primary education.
Yes.
Upbeat and spirited and possibly described as sassy as a teenager, mm-hmm. or, God forbid, ghetto.
Uh-huh.
You grew up in Detroit and, quote, like many brown girls, she was bullied for her dark skin tone and often relegated to boxes much too small to fit her brilliance. What can you tell me about how this all went into starting Ghetto Mantras?
Ooh, I mean, that's just it. Everything went into starting Ghetto Mantras, just my whole upbringing, right? Like, I used to be teased so much. People say, you ghetto, and I would just say, oh, I hate that. But then I realized that for me, ghetto is just, it's just my creativity. It's my color. It's who I am, and it's not a bad thing. It's my seasoning, right? Especially when you talk about a blackety-black market, you know, in Black culture. The best part about Black food is the seasoning that we put on it. You know what I mean? And so that's how I see myself. That's what ghetto is for me now. It's my way of doing things. And so my whole upbringing led me to this moment, to having Ghetto Mantras, which is a self-care brand that focuses on Black women and using their language to help them get through their day or get through those moments that might be a little bit hard.
So what can you tell me a little bit about that self-care line? Like, what can people potentially expect to find at the Blackity Black Holiday Market, for instance?
So I'm really hoping whoever sees this comes to the Blackity Black Holiday Market, because this is my return from maternity leave. I have been on maternity leave for the better part of the year, and I'm coming back. But really what we have is a self-care package, right? And so the first item in there is a book of mantras. It's myself and about 6 other authors, and we write out daily anecdotes to help you through your day, no matter if it's up, down, left, right. Whatever it is, it's something in there to help you. We also have a crew neck. 2 crew necks. We have the pink one, which it says, sometimes you got to keep the love and light to yourself. And just for recent happenings in this country, sometimes as Black women, we do have to keep the love and light to ourselves. And the second crew neck I have is a crew neck that I created to combat shame. And it's just a bunch of different sayings on there. So I hope whomever comes to check us out, is candles in the package, affirmation bracelets. It's just all kinds of things that you need just as little self-reminders to say, this is what I'm doing to make myself feel better or to get through my day.
I love that. And what does an experience like this type of holiday market, to showcase, you know, your business, but also a lot of other businesses with just kind of a creative kaleidoscope of products and services and things like that, what does it mean to you?
The Blackity Black Market is so special because of its purpose, right? It's meant to highlight black entrepreneurs. And kind of like what Tariq was saying, marketing is that number one thing. And so for Hyphen and Radio Milwaukee to take this platform and to give this to small black-owned businesses, it does mean a lot because it's an audience that we potentially may have never reached. You know, you and I kind of had some conversation prior, and Milwaukee is now being one of my second homes. I don't know as many people, and you have to get out there into the community and if you want to kind of, you know, launch your business or make it known.
Is there anything that you're looking for? Like, are you in the market right now for lotion or for snack gifts or anything like that that you're going to be looking for at the market aside from your products?
I'm going to look for things that catch my eye. I'm going to look for a unique product experiences through products at this market, which I know I will get from them.
And are you both in markets for gifts for loved ones at this time of year?
Yeah, I'm always looking for gifts. It's better than gift cards, I'll tell you that.
Right.
The thing about this is that you're looking to, you know, shift the landscape of Milwaukee and of the Midwest, Tariq, right? You're looking for kind of like a new approach to showcasing entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like she's from Detroit. I'm originally from Atlanta. And you go to Atlanta, it's a different environment for black businesses. And I want to create that same energy and vibe, but with the Milwaukee state of mind, right? Milwaukee is a 40% black city. And wherever I go, people don't even realize that, don't even know that, you know? And I want to use Hyphen, not only for the businesses, but for the artists, for the creators, to know, not just in Milwaukee, but outside of Milwaukee, you know, there's some amazing black talent, amazing black businesses, amazing black art in this city, and it deserves to be put a spotlight on.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Is this your first year, Givenchy?
This is my first year at the Blackity Black Market, and so I'm really excited to meet everybody, to make connections, and to kind of, like you said, amplify what Hyphen has going on for us.
There's something that feels good about not only supporting local, but also supporting black businesses when you know the environment has been like it's been.
It's challenging, you know, and there's some great products. Like, there's a New Orleans, I guess he's from New Orleans. There's a po' boy shop on Burleigh and MLK, and I drive by and I'm like, call who that po' boys? I didn't know, there was no blog about there, was no press release about that. And then I saw them, I tried them, I'm like, wow, this is great. Like, but then, you know,
more people need to know about it. Like, you know. Otherwise, it's not going to stay there for a very long time.
So another thing that Hyphen's doing, we have a, thanks to our underwriting director, who also has marketing experience, we just recently launched at our anti-gala, the Black Small Business Initiative. So basically, it will provide $100,000 worth of resources, including advertising on not only Hyphen, but Radio Milwaukee platform. For selected up to 5 businesses. So there's an application program going on right now where you not only get that, but one-on-one resources, one-on-one counseling on marketing, not just on radio, but just to help that business out to grow and reach new audiences. So that's happening now. So we're really trying to, you know, fill a gap, you know, using our platform, our media platform, to help get the word out for these businesses.
And, you know, we've got things like MKE Black with the app, and you can find black businesses there. But what's your message to, like, the consumer out there, or, like, just the person living in Milwaukee who's, like, you know, maybe they're a little bit of a procrastinator about their holiday gifts, but they want to, you know, this could be a really good experience for them?
I mean, one, you get to, you know, come out and enjoy some great music and vibes. But also get to support some businesses that you might never heard of. You might be surprised and like, wow, I didn't even know this existed. Mm-hmm. Right? That is the best feeling in the world. You're like, to find this little secret thing and like, oh my God, I didn't know this existed. Like, I think that's the thing I would say. You know, Milwaukee is very proud to be local, right? This is an opportunity to really resonate that for a community that definitely, you know, needs the support.
Yes.
Javonche, did you want to add something to the message to who has ever, maybe they've never seen Ghetto Mantras or, you know, just all the cool stuff that they can find at the market?
I mean, for someone who's never seen Ghetto Mantras, I would just say, you know, you'll be interested to find, not only through the product experience, but the community of women that we have built online, you'll be interested to find a soft place to land with us. So come find a soft place to land at the Blackity Black Holiday Market.
All right. Thank you so much, Tariq and Javonche.
Thank you.
Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
That was Tariq Moody, Creative Director of Hyphen, Milwaukee's digital first Black music and culture platform, and Javonche Hudnall-Vogel of Ghetto Mantras, a Black woman-run wellness brand. They each spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver. Hyphen's Blackity Black Holiday Market is happening at the Turner Hall Ballroom this Saturday. A new season of Bubbler Talk is underway, but we still need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break and then return with the latest episode in our Live at Lake Effect series. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Live at Lake Effect is our music series featuring artists performing in the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood. We brought the Lake Effects together, along with Visionary Studios, to showcase local and nationally touring musicians. Today, we have the Cosmic Crooners, the experimental country folk rock indie band from Portland, Oregon, Blitz and Trapper. They've been together for over 20 years and recently released their 10th album, Hundreds of Thousands, Millions of Billions. Here's Blitz and Trapper performing Fur.
Yeah, when I was only 17, I could hear the angels whispering. So I drove into the woods and wandered aimlessly about, till I heard my mother shouting through the fog. It turned out to be the howling of a dog, or a wolf to be exact. The sound sent shivers down my back, but I was drawn into the pack, and before long they allowed me to join in and sing their song. From the cliffs and higher still, yeah, we would gladly get our fill, howling endlessly and shrilly at the dawn. And I lost the taste for judging right from wrong, for my flesh had turned to fur, yeah, and my thoughts they surely were turned to instinct and obedience to God. You better be sure if you're making God a liar. I'm a rattlesnake, babe. I'm like fuel on fire. So if you're gonna get me, don't be afraid of what you learn. On the day that I turned 23, I was curled up underneath the dogwood tree, when suddenly a girl, her skin the color of a pearl, she wandered aimlessly, but she did not seem to see. And she was listening for the angels just like me. So I stood and looked about and brushed the leaves off of my snout. And then I heard my mother shouting through the trees. Yeah, should have seen that girl go shaky at the knees. So I took her by the arm and we settled down upon a farm and raised our children up as gently as you please. My fur has turned to skin, and I've been quickly ushered in to a world that I confess I do not know. But I still dream of running careless through the snow, through the howling winds that blow, across the ancient distant flow, fills our bodies up like water till we know. Like a river on fire, but you better be sure if you're making God a liar. I'm a rattlesnake, babe. I'm like fuel on fire. So if you're gonna get made, don't be afraid of what you learn.
Hi, this is Audrey Nowakowski from Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We're here at the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood, along with Milwaukee musician and Live at Lake Effect co-producer Trapper Shep. Hey, Trapper.
Audrey, we have a band in today, and I just love their band name so much, Blitzen Trapper. And I ran into these guys at a sushi shop in Nashville once, and I approached them with my driver's license. I set it down on the table, and I said, I'm a trapper, too. You guys probably don't remember that, but I have a pretty clear memory. But before that, let's introduce everybody in the group. Who's on the allergy pill bottle?
Oh, that would be me. I'm Brian Cook.
Thank you, Brian. Yeah. And what kind of allergy pills? Is it Zyrtec?
This is one of several that I take. This is cetirizine, and this is sort of the preferred shaker for today's session.
It's perfect. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I'm Eric Early.
I'm Nathan Vanderpool.
Thank you guys for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So behind the band name, where did that come from one trapper to another?
I've made up about five or six different lies about it. The favorite lie is that in sixth grade, well, it's not entirely a lie, although it may be. In sixth grade, I had a Christmas-themed Trapper Keeper that I would keep all my, you know, pens in and my writings and my crappy poems. And all my love letters from my sixth grade girlfriend were in there. Unfortunately, one day during class, I was found slipping a note to her, and the teacher took the Trapper Keeper, and I never saw it again.
Amazing.
Did it had reindeers on it, though?
It had Santa Claus riding a reindeer.
Oh, yeah.
People always ask me, where does your Trapper come from? And I sometimes flip a coin between Trapper Keeper or Trapper John M.D.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I'm just used to you as Trapper, and I totally forgot about Trapper Keepers as a thing. That's it. Now we are. Yeah, so... the songs from your latest and 10th album, Hundreds of Thousands, Millions of Billions, contain song ideas from a box of four-track tapes that you, Eric, made in the 90s. So can you talk about the process of revisiting your work? And really quickly, for any younger listeners unfamiliar, can you explain what the four-track is?
Well, there's these things called cassettes. They're sort of this piece of plastic with some magnetic tape inside, and they turn. There's actual movement involved. It's quite cosmic, actually. So the music comes off of this magnetic tape that spins inside of another machine. There's a lot of machines involved, and they all spin. They turn, just like the stars, basically. And so I had a lot of these little plastic cassette tapes that I had recorded lots of songs on when I was 19, 18, 20 maybe, 21. A lot of it's me and Brian, too. And there's probably like 100 of these tapes, maybe more.
Yeah, I probably got at least 50 or 60 of them.
Yeah, I got them in an old cardboard box under the stairs at my house. And so occasionally I'll pull them out and sort of listen through a few of them. So I was doing that, and I was like, oh, there's a couple here that I like. I want to rework, you know. So, yeah, there's probably three or four on there that are from that old group of strange spinning plastic cassettes.
Yeah. Well, for both of you, that's kind of a moment where it's like, oh, thanks, younger self. What stood out to you both about revisiting what you did years and years ago?
Yeah, for sure.
Any through lines?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I would imagine... I mean, I reworked some of the lyrics for some of the songs and some of the different ideas and concepts involved. But for the most part, yeah, I think younger Eric was a little bit more in flow state than older Eric has been. And lately I've been sort of trying to enter that flow state once again and sort of relearn some things. That's nice.
And for you, Brian?
The only one of the songs that I recognize as being an older demo, the other ones that were old, I didn't realize. So I think that they fit in perfectly.
I was listening to the new album and I was reminded at how your writing has always been so cool, cosmic, and has had these spiritual elements to it. And today you playing Fur, I'm thinking about reincarnation, and then you're playing Planetarium as well. And I feel that it touches upon all these Buddhist themes of rebirth and letting go. I'm curious how Buddhism and meditation has affected your life on and off stage?
Well, yeah, over the past 6 years, I've kind of gone deep down into that rabbit hole of practice. And it's been really good for me, saved my marriage, really, and allowed me to sort of keep doing the work that I do without burning out, you know? And I think it's been a through line in my life. As a child, I would go into these really old bookstores that they used to have full of books. You don't see much anymore. There would usually be one person working behind the counter and then all these different rooms full of old books. And as a child, I would always gravitate to the Eastern mysticism section. I don't really know why. And so I sort of forgot about that as I grew older. But then now as I'm older, I realize, like, oh, there was something there that was drawing me. And so now I've kind of, like, just given myself up to it, you know what I mean? Just being like, all right, fine, this is my thing.
Finding ways to balance and avoid burnout. Eric, I know you work for Greater Good Northwest back home in Portland, and I'm sure you all have other jobs as well. So how does being in this group for so long and balancing, you know, you have your job, and then you have your passion job with this for all three of you, what have you learned, especially post-pandemic, to keep that balance and to still stay present in music when you are together?
I mean, I think, for me, that the job itself sort of was part of my gateway to trying to figure out ways and means to just be happy and not be constantly full of anxiety, you know? And part of it was because in that job, I started to, like, I just kind of started doing that work in shelters and stuff. It was kind of like, not a lark, but just like, I was not touring as much, and I was like, oh, I should get a day job. And buddy's like, oh, I'm doing night shift at the shelter. It's like, okay. So I sort of just got into it that way, just sort of like accidentally. And then the learning curve was so steep that I was just like, oh, my gosh, the world is crazy. It's just not what I thought, you know what I mean? Because I spent so many years just touring on the road. And so for me, it all kind of goes together, the job I do and my practice and kind of the way I see my music now.
On a less serious note, fans of the TV show The Office may be interested in what is called the Blitzen Trapper Massacre. Mm-hmm. Can you explain such a thing?
Oh, it's a short film that lives on the internet, specifically on YouTube, and maybe on Soul Pancake, if that still exists. Rainn Wilson was a fan of ours, and he reached out through Twitter when we were on Twitter, and just started a dialogue, and it slowly turned into the notion of making something together while we were in LA. We were gonna be there soon. And so he came down to the venue, the El Rey, and spent the whole afternoon with us just filming this silly thing that we wrote together. And the idea is just that he is so obsessed that he thinks that he's going to be on stage with us, and we reject him. And then he kills us all in anger.
That's fair.
One by one, in special ways.
It is fair. I would have done the same.
And then he takes the stage by himself at the end.
Covered in blood.
Yeah. It was really fun. I was starstruck to hang out with him, and his generosity was vast to spend the whole day with us and create this thing just for fun.
Your generosity is vast, gentlemen, for waking up early, being here with us at a surf shop in Wisconsin, as weird as that is. So thank you, Blitz and Trapper.
Thanks so much.
We love you. Thanks for the good music. Yeah,
thanks for having us. Yeah,
pleasure.
You guys are great.
Brian Cook, Eric Early, Nathan Vanderpool, and Michael Elson make up the band Blitz and Trapper. Be sure to head to WUWM.com and our YouTube page to watch them performing three original songs in the Lake Effect Surf Shop. Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep and myself are the executive producers of Live at Lake Effect. Sound engineering is done by WUWM's Jason Reavy, and thanks to our friends at Visionary Studios, a local advertising agency, for filming and editing this episode. WUWM's YouTube page has our past episodes of Live at Lake Effect featuring Joseph Huber, Cactus Blossoms, Willie Carlisle, Buffalo Nickels, Raina, and many more. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we hear about the discovery of sinkholes in Lake Michigan. And we'll visit La Finca Coffee House, a family-owned coffee shop specializing in Mexican cuisine. Join us tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. And I'm lost up.